Welcome. This is Why Life Is, and I'm your host, Niles McFlower. Yes, and tonight we have another great, great show dealing with metaphysics, physics, spirituality, and a number of other related subjects. As a matter of fact, this is possibly as big as you get because tonight's show is on the life of God. Now, you might say that even the title lacks humility, but in reality, it's going to be my presentation tonight that suggests that a part of God is to actually understand God for all human beings and other life as well, at least life higher in consciousness than human beings. And therefore, to talk about the life of God is to talk about how much we understand of God. It doesn't mean that I'm going to be explaining everything there could be to said about God, because everything about God is everything that exists within our universe, and possibly more. So that leads us into an area we can't cover in probably the 2 hours we have tonight. But nonetheless, I think we can touch on enough things, such as how did God come into existence? Some of you may know the answer to that if you've read Life's Hidden Meaning or some other material I've written, or possibly if you've listened to some other shows I've done on this radio station and also on several others. So let me begin by defining what I mean by God so that we know whose life we're really talking about. I'm talking about God as the creator of the universe as we know of it and as yet may not know, or the majority of people may not know of it. So the entire universe as we understand it, the creator of that universe is what I'm talking about when I talk about God. God's life includes things that have encompassed in total all that has occurred within this universe and in some circumstances outside of this universe. So that's what I'm talking about when I say the life of God. I'm talking about everything that's going on. Everywhere we have awareness and a lack of awareness of within our universe. And then beyond that as well. So is God the only God or creator of our universe? And I'm going to answer that question in a little bit. I'm going to give you some other questions as well that might be of interest to some people. Is God an all-powerful, all-knowing, all-understanding, all-creative being? And the answer to that I will also answer, and it's not just a yes. And also, some other questions that I thought would be appropriate to answer is, how does something come from nothing? How did God, if God is the creator, what or who created God? I'm going to answer that question in just a few minutes, that one. And some other questions that I thought were appropriate. Is God intimately aware of and involved with the life that exists within our universe, and especially human beings? Because some people believe very strongly that is a true statement, yes, and some say, well, even if there's a God, it doesn't care about us. Okay. And if God exists and God is all good and all powerful, then how come evil exists? That's an old argument. But we'll touch on that one. It's a very simple answer, but nonetheless, a lot of people have pondered it without coming up with an answer for themselves. Okay, so, and then a lot of other questions. I don't want to belabor too many because you'll start forgetting them anyway. I would, anyway. And I think it's important to maybe just jump into this subject. Because the interesting thing about this is I am trying to paint or to design or to express a portrait of a being, a real being, that has a real life, and that is not some kind of storybook figure in the sky or something like that. Because most people, I think, have trouble picturing a God that has a life. It's a little easier to picture a God than it is a God with its own life, which kind of seems a little hard to understand. So, let's start with, where did God come from? God is this all great, fantastic being. Then, who created God? And the simplest answer, which I will explain in great detail, is God is a self-created being. But that doesn't quite make sense until you understand the rest of the story, which I'm going to go into now. So let's get on with that. Oh, by the way, I forgot to mention, in case you are listening on a computer but would prefer to listen on the telephone, which means you wouldn't have to stay where you're at, you can dial into 712-432-0075, and that will connect you up. So you can listen into the show and be anywhere, really, at least anywhere that number works. And, if you want to call into the station and talk to me while we're on air, 877-876-5227 and 888-815-9756 for those of you in Canada. The reason I'm saying those numbers is because some people are calling in, but they don't have those numbers readily handy. Okay, let me go on now. Where did God come from? I mean, come on. That's the old chicken and the egg thing, you know? You need to kind of get a little into science here and physics. You know, we talk about some of that stuff. Now, I don't claim to be the world's greatest physicist, but I do consider myself sort of a junior level physicist, maybe a little bit better than that in some circumstances. And this is the point I'm going to make here. There's a part of physics some of you are familiar with called quantum physics. And more importantly, there's a part of quantum physics called quantum field theory. It really developed after the 1940s and much later in time than at the turn of the 20th century when quantum physics started to become developed. So this area of physics was really developed much later. And what does it do? Well, quantum field theory compares the probability of one field of probabilities affecting another field of probabilities. And a field is a self-limiting or in some way limited field of probabilities. So once you have any field that is limited by something, and I will go into the various limitations, once you have a bunch of probabilities that are limited by something, then that becomes a field. Okay, I'll say that one more time because I kind of confused myself and you by saying what I started to say. Once you have a lot of probabilities, a group of probabilities, and they become limited for some reason, then that becomes a field of probabilities. And quantum field theory is how one field of probabilities is affected by another field of probabilities. It's the science of that kind of interference sometimes and support other times. And it's all based on probabilities, not based upon actual known sums of things. Okay, that's what quantum field theory is about. And knowing that brings us to how God is a self-created being. Let's go into this. In the beginning, and maybe for all of every part of existence, we could claim, with some degree of authority, really, that there is an infinite field of possibilities for all things that have been, are, and ever will be. Infinite field. Now you could say, well, how could an infinite field actually be limited? Well, we're going to get to that. Because it would have to be able to be limited in some way in order to be even called a field. But I'm going to say there's an infinite number of things to begin with, and I'm going to tell you how that infinite number of things becomes a field and becomes limited, and therefore is an infinite field of possibilities. Okay? Ready? All right. Let's say we have infinite possibilities before it's even a field, at least in our mind, although it may always be a field. And within that field, some things are more likely to occur than others. Because if we have infinite possibilities, then there is an infinite and complete, the only thing that's assured, factor of there being variability in possibilities. Otherwise, there wouldn't be infinite possibilities. There would only be one. And one would be obviously going to be the same. So infinite possibilities means that there are a lot of choices within this particular field. Just because there's a lot of choices, though, doesn't mean the field is limited in any way. There's just a lot of choices. However, in an infinite field of possibilities, some choices are going to be closer to, similar to, or the same, or likely, like of like kind of some sort, to other choices rather than choices that are very different from those choices. So the choices that are similar to each other, very similar to the point where we would say they look like they're the same, there may be some differences, but they have enough similarity. Those choices will tend to do something we call gravitate. They move in a direction that is similar because the choices themselves are having an effect on the field. Let me explain what that effect is. Every choice that has a consistency to it and has other choices that are similar to it has an effect on the field by causing the field to be limited more towards those choices than to total chaos, random choices that have no connection to any other choices or very few connections to any other choices. If you're following me, and this is not easy to follow, so if you're saying, oh, you're scratching your head, what did he just say? Let me say it again, and I'll say it sort of like by example. Let's say you got a bunch of friends and yourself, and you got some people that are not friends, and they don't have anything to do with any of your friends because their choices are so much different from yours and your friends. Their choices are so random and so chaotic that they have no effect on their surroundings because they are so much going against each other at times and so much not in accord with each other that they're kind of canceling each other out. Whereas you and your friends, because you're getting together and you're choosing to do a number of things, let's say that some of those things include going to a baseball game together. Maybe you like to play tennis and dance. Maybe you like to go to movies. Maybe you like to do certain kinds of work together. Those choices, because they are similar, have an effect on all the other choices that are random around because those choices affect the environment. Those choices are, in a way, making the field around them into something that is consistent and similar. They have a direction to themselves. Whereas the chaotic choices that are just random, they don't have any direction. They even cancel each other out, so there's nothing going on. Okay. So So now, if we look at an infinite field of choices, because some of the choices are similar and sympathetic to each other and synergistic with each other and cause a direction towards a change in the field, because there is a field now, even though it's an infinite field of choices, some of them are causing the field to change. And that in itself becomes something new. If enough of these choices come together and create a change that is consistent, we can say that the choices together are starting to become like willful over the entire limited field of infinite choices, then suddenly you've got something unique going on. And the cool thing is that you actually have a kind of being being developed, a being with choices with a commonality of direction. That being is not God. That's a giant director of an infinite field of choices, which is now within the area of its direction, no longer in an infinite field, but it's changed some of that infinite field into its own field of directed choices. The infinite field still surrounds it, but it has its own little niche. And you could call that being a director of a huge infinite field of choices that it has created into its own niche. That's cool. Still not God, and I'll explain why. Although this being, which is a great being, there's no question about it, it has to be some enormous form of literally direction of choices to take a huge infinite field and be able to do what we're talking about doing. The reason it isn't God is because it hasn't done something that's really, really different other than getting a large amount of consciousness together, because the direction of the choices, another word for that in our language, is it has developed consciousness. The direction gives consciousness to this being. But just because it's conscious, it's not yet God, because God is a creator. In order to be a creator, certain things have to happen. And so since this is the beginning of a potential God, we have to look at the very beginning. It is obviously self-created. It came about because a number of choices just made their direction common with other choices, and they did so enough of the time to have a limitation on an infinite field of possibilities. Whoa. But there's another step. And the next step is this. If you want to be a God, like the God of our universe, you have to become the creator of the universe. And the universe is something way different than this infinite field of choices, or even than the field of choices of a director within the infinite field of choices, making it into a limited field. So something new has to take place, and let me tell you what that is. God needs to create by sacrificing its complete control, which a director has of a limited field of choices, a limited field of choices with its common direction in an infinite field. A director has complete control. But you know what? It also has complete boredom. And usually directors will do one of two things. They'll either over time completely bore themselves out of existence, or they'll become creators. To become a creator, a director has to limit itself in its consciousness and its choices. And it has to do something very different from what directors normally do, which is just to hang out and experience their own choices going in similar directions. It's got to choose to create a universe like ours. And once it has made that choice, it's going to need to choose to limit itself instead of the field. Limit itself instead of the field. Because remember, by limiting the field is how it came into existence. But it stops limiting the field and instead sacrifices that to grow itself. Because it realizes that if it is all that there is, and all that it is, there is its own choices, then there's no growth potential for itself. So in order to grow, it has to sacrifice the, we'll call it, ultimate power and control over everything. It's got to give that up. It's got to create a universe like our universe, or other universes that are more complicated, but that's a different story for right now. We're just talking about how the God of our universe came into existence. And once it becomes a fixed, we'll say, puts its consciousness squarely into the field of our universe, it simultaneously creates something that replaces its choices and replaces the direction to its choices somewhat. I'm going to get to the somewhat part in a few minutes. And so it says, hey, here I am, and I've decided that I want to grow instead of just being a boring director of things that's over and over the same stuff. So I'm going to limit my choices. I'm going to limit the amount of direction I give, not give it up, but I'm going to limit it. And I'm going to give this to something new, and to something new I'm going to call life. Yep, life. Now you might say, hey, isn't this show called Why Life Is? Yep, it is. So you might see how this all kind of fits together for the show anyway. Yeah, that's right. Why Life Is. Okay. So life is because God wants to grow. That's a good way of putting it, right? At least as I'm suggesting right now. Okay, so God does this, and it's an amazing thing because it's the greatest sacrifice of anything in the universe they could ever create, because God created everything so that it can grow. And he has to create things even before there's life because it decides that just creating life itself would be too easy. Let's start at a pre-life condition and let that develop eventually into life. But God does not go away. Now, I know some people think that it does. Some Buddhists, depending upon what kind of Buddhist you are, believe that. Some deists believe that. Certainly some atheists believe that, if they believe God ever existed at all. And so you have a lot of people that may not go along with what I'm suggesting right now. But if they're listening, and I hope they are, this may give them alternatives, because a lot of people are those other things because they can't get past who created God, how did the universe begin, and how is it going to end, and questions that have answers, but they haven't found them, and since they haven't found them, they move in a direction and say, well, I don't know if I'm going to believe in God at all if I can't hear those questions answered. So we'll answer those tonight. Okay, so here we go. God has got this system in its mind, and the mind is that, hey, I already know about the two parts that I'm going to use of my mind. The first is choices, and the second is direction. I've given up most of the choices to give to life, and I'm giving up some, but not nearly all, of the direction. You can say, well, what's going on with this direction business? Isn't that the consciousness of God that you said was so, of the director that becomes the consciousness of God that is so fantastic? Yeah, it's going to keep some of its consciousness, and the way it keeps it is this. It doesn't impose its choices with direction onto any living thing. Never. It does not do so. It does onto pre-life. Pre-living things, it actually imposes its choices with direction. So those could be called the rules or laws in physics of the universe. Okay? Now, there's a lot of scientists who say, well, gee, if I just know what those laws are, I understand God. Not quite, no. You see, that's just the pre-life. And pre-life doesn't get you very far. It gets you into the door, the lower door of God's mind, which we're going to talk about in a couple minutes, but it doesn't get you up into the thought processes. So you don't see spirit. You see only things. And that's one of the problems that some scientists have. Okay. So God's got this great plan that it's going to apply its choices with direction together to things that are not yet living. They're pre-life. And those are going to be called laws, like scientific laws of the universe. And it applies to more than just the dimension of time and space that we presently live in, to six other major dimensions as well that are actually more involved, more significantly in complexity and size, greater than where we are. That's okay. It does that too. But right now, I'm going to keep us right where we are, which is in the physical part of the universe. Okay, so God does that. And then it says, you know, for life, I'm going to remove most of the choices. I'm not going to will my choices onto life. Life's going to have its own free will. I'm going to will my choices onto pre-life, because that's okay. I don't think I'm interfering with anything. But with life, I'm going to leave those choices alone for the most part. There's some exceptions here and there, rarely. But for the most part, I'm just leaving the choices alone, and I'm going to keep direction when choices are being made only to this extent. My consciousness, which is my direction, affects that life that can understand some level of my consciousness. But it has no effect, or limited, very limited effect, on any life that doesn't understand or know my consciousness. Okay, so you're following, I'm hoping, what I'm saying, but I'll give you an example, because I know that last thing can be a little hard to understand. Hey, I'm God, and I see some tree frogs kind of running around doing their thing. And I say, well, you know, those tree frogs, sometimes they don't do the best things in the world, necessarily. Sometimes they do a lot of things that really aren't good for some other creatures. But sometimes they do wonderful things, and sometimes they're changing and being creative. And they have a soul that they're collectively part of, so they have this instinctual thing which kind of guides them, which is okay. But I'm not going to interfere with the choices of that soul either, because that's still part of life. And so as far as the tree frogs are concerned, they're free to choose to do whatever the heck they want to do. And the soul of those tree frogs can also choose to do whatever it wants to do. Now, if and when tree frogs become great enough in consciousness to understand my direction, the way I would like tree frogs to live, and what I would like them to do in benefits to the environment, etc., once that happens, then that type of life can experience my own direction, my own consciousness, and be a part of my direction. Now, that part of life usually starts with human beings. So let's say we've got a few human beings running around, and they notice the tree frogs are doing certain things which are beneficial, and other kinds of life, including their own, including people's life, are interfering at times with tree frogs, to the point where the benefits that tree frogs are doing in the life process are not being helped, and they're being significantly harmed. But some of the human beings can say, wait a second, I can sense God's consciousness, the direction that God wants for life, and tree frogs need to have some free choices that they're being limited on by other kinds of life, especially human life. And I want to prevent that from taking place. So I'm going to become a little bit of a conservationist. I also may slightly mingle in with certain types of bacteria and viruses and a couple of fungi that adversely affect the tree frogs. I'm going to find ways of balancing those fungi and viruses behind the scenes, of course, by trees in the root system, binding those kinds of pesty little things from getting too much into the tree frogs. And the tree itself actually builds a defense in their bark where the tree frogs are living. Tree frogs pick up a little of that defense in living in the tree and now are immune themselves, and everybody's working together, and it's cool. Yeah. Okay. So that's all coming about, and that's all the way it's supposed to be. And I may encourage that by not overcutting trees. I may encourage that by not poisoning soils or not causing runoffs that destroys the systems below the soil, which is where the stuff grows. And so I'm doing all these things. And I'm doing it because I understand part of God's consciousness, which is actually half of God's thought. God's thought is the direction to its choices with the choices. God's consciousness is just the direction of the choices. So that's the amazing thing. And the choices themselves have light to them if they build more consciousness. And the choices, if they build chaos and destroy direction to the choices, then you get darkness. This isn't so hard, maybe. Okay. So that's the cool thing about it. And that's really neat, because now we got a system where there is free will, and there is also consciousness that can be shared and understood by those beings that have developed enough of it themselves, usually starting with humans, sometimes those pets, and the highest level of mammals and animals that are close to humans can also develop some level of consciousness of God. They can actually participate in the direction of God's choices. Wow. And there are also group souls that have developed themselves as part of the instincts of whole classes of animals and sometimes plants that have developed enough consciousness to understand God. And so they help in the instinct arena to help develop life that will do the same. So behind certain kinds of life forms that we think of as independent, they really aren't, because they have instincts. And if instincts are controlling them, then you can say that there's something of spirit involved, and the spirit is the consciousness along with the choices of God being recognized and exercised upon. Pretty neat stuff. Pretty neat. Now, if you are a co-creator in this process with God, you're not only working just in God's consciousness, but you're also working in its choices, but you're developing consciousness, you're developing choices that are unique, but at the same time, not against the choices of God. They just supplement or are additive. This is what God wants. God wants life to make its own choices and have a direction that's similar to God's, but not the same in every circumstance. And the choices are not the identical choices of God's. They're the choices of the beings that are making them. So there's free will. If we take free will out of the equation, we go back to the director of a field, and we lose the whole purpose. Maybe not the whole purpose, but a big purpose of God's, which is for it to be both self-creative in the beginning, self-created in the beginning, but then other-created through the choices of all that it has helped to create. Wow. What a big system. And it works. Why does it work? Because it accomplishes the goals of our Creator. It accomplishes the goals of God. If you know of another system, and I'm serious about this step, please, in humility, I hope. If you know of another system that works as good or better, please let me know. I have been searching for a very, very long time from courses in comparative religions way back when I was a a youngster, so to speak, in my beginning years in college, to every other kind of study and investigation, including into psychology and the physical sciences, etc., to see if there is a better system, even if there's another system that really works. So far, I have not found. So I am open to hearing about it. And the first thing I usually ask people that say that, well, you don't know what you're talking about, et cetera, God is blank, blank, where is the system? Where is the purpose? Where is the growth of a being of God? Because a God that doesn't grow has the problem of the director of a field. That problem is boredom and tedious, infinite tediousness, which would be possibly some kind of hellish existence over any period of time. Okay. And speaking of time, why don't we talk about that very quickly, and then we'll go to break. Time is an invention of God. Time comes from the free will that God gives with the exercise of choices within that free will that are sometimes inconsistent with the choices that had already been made by God just to create the universe in terms of the pre-life conditions. So anything that makes choices that are different from the initial choice of God's to make the laws, the very basic laws of the universe, becomes a creator of time. We'll get into how and why that would be true in a physics sense in a little bit, if we have time tonight to do so. But nonetheless, that gives you some idea of how the beginning of this process is. And then again, before we go to break, I want to tell you about the third part of God's mind. Okay, God's got these two parts, which are really cool. We call them spirit because it's the choices with the direction together is the first two parts of God's mind. And put together, create God's thought, which is also another word for spirit. And that's a cool thing. But there's a third part to God's plan. And that is these laws that it makes that we call the pre-life laws are actually founded upon something called intelligent interactions. Okay, intelligent interactions. How one part can communicate to another part and do so using the least amount of energy and eventually no energy necessary in order to do so, and how the universe has the ability, therefore, to create things, form, actually from nothing, in a sense, but actually it's from the third part of God's mind. So as long as there is perfect intelligent interaction, there's no energy, but as soon as there's a lack of this intelligent interaction, there's bingo, bango, huge amounts of energy created, which also causes time to start because some of the choices that the energy is involved in are completely different from and sometimes even inconsistent with the choices made by God, and then you have something called force, which is developed. Okay, all of that said, that may have you may be saying, ha, 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 what, what. Well, that's the reason we're going to go to break. And when we come back from break, I'll try to explain it in a little simpler way. And then we'll continue on to understand the life of God. So we'll be back in about 2.5 minutes from right now.
Hun, what book are you reading?
It's a novel, kind of, about romance, love, and spiritual life in general.
Kind of a novel? What do you mean?
Well, it's based on some real-life experiences and even real characters. Some of their experiences are fascinating and remarkable. I can't put this book down.
How come the title is Afterlife Love?
That's part of the fascination. This book describes the afterlife in intricate detail and even explains why things are the way they're explained.
But how can anyone write about or know that?
Some of the characters travel out of body to some places that people who've already died also go to. I'm finding it completely believable because it all makes sense and fits into a bigger picture for me.
Hun, what happens to these people?
You can read it for yourself when I'm done if you want.
Better yet, I'll get my own copy so we can discuss it while we read. Let me see. I'll write down the title. It's Afterlife Love by Niles McFlower. McFlower.
Afterlife Love is available in some bookstores and from the publisher at agelesswisdom.com or 480-966-3132. That's 480-966-3132.
Hi, everyone. Since childhood, I've had questions about my life and life in general that I couldn't find adequate answers to. Questions like, why am I here? Why are others here? Does the universe have a purpose? And how does that relate to my life? More recently, I've been wondering what happens when we die, especially the reasons why. I'm more of a doubter than a believer in many things, and answers that include the whys allow me to think and figure out the truth for myself. I've been reading a book, Life's Hidden Meaning. This one book contains more answers, including the whys, than all other sources I've read or heard. It's amazing to me that every one of my questions has been thoroughly answered. More importantly, I have found that all of these answers so far have checked out to be true. I hope this message helps some of you in your quest for better understanding. The name of this wonderful book is, again, Life's Hidden Meaning by metaphysician Niles McFlower. Some bookstores sell it. I got my copy directly from the publisher at agelesswisdom.com. Life's Hidden Meaning may enlighten your mind and bring some peace and joy to your heart.
Back. This is Why Life Is, and I'm your host, Niles McFlower. Tonight we're talking about the life of God. Oh, it's a small subject, really. Of course, I am definitely kidding around with that. Okay, so God's third part of its mind. This third part of its mind starts off with all the laws of physics. All of the laws we do know and don't know, some of which we've found. We found a lot of the laws of physics, at least in the physical part of the universe, but we don't know what they mean. Because if you exclude God's purpose, which is its choices and its will now, not the will of life itself, and you also exclude God's direction, which is its consciousness, its love, its virtue, then you don't really get what these laws are about. You don't see the forest through the trees. And this is a difficulty. Why would God want to make a universe that has universal laws that have to only be understood when you have spirit connected to them? Because that's what we're really saying. You can't really understand these laws unless you understand spirit, which is the first two parts of God's mind. And there's a good rationale to this. If you were to truly understand automatically the first two parts of God's mind by just understanding the laws of physics, you could abuse the laws. You might become some kind of super evil thing and go in a very negative direction, and to safeguard the universe from evil becoming so powerful that even God can't stop it, nothing could stop it, God made a very wise choice. And that choice was to make sure that you had to have high enough consciousness to be able to truly understand its own laws. So evil can understand only the superficiality of these laws. Evil can make hydrogen bombs. Evil can destroy tree frogs. evil can wipe out whole planets sometimes. However, it can't destroy the universe. And the reason for that is that evil loses consciousness rather than gains consciousness and never has high enough consciousness to be able to understand enough of the laws to be able to do the things that I said. So the power of evil is limited by its lack of understanding its own creator. And this is the safeguard, the safety net that God created so that we can all remain in existence and still have and allow true free will, even for human beings, most importantly, who are more the almost the entire source of evil. So human beings have free will, but with all the free will that they have, they don't have sufficient consciousness to be able to use the third part of God's mind, which are all the laws of physics and all the pre-life kinds of forms that exist, that are not in life yet, to gain power for themselves, the evil ones. Yet they are so limited in how much they can do this that they cannot overcome the direction of God in general for life in general. Evil could never, ever take over a universe designed by God because God did this thing that I just explained. Now, a lot of people think that isn't a true statement. They think, well, if it's laissez-faire, and God gave free will, then evil may win. Nope. The dice are loaded. There's no way around it. Evil can never, ever win because if you understand how God created the universe, it's very clear that evil never had and never will have the opportunity to destroy the universe. It can do some harm. And serious harm to the growth of life, which is God's growth. And God suffers for that, just as all of life does. So let's talk about that. God sacrificed a good deal of what we would consider to be its total beingness in order to create a universe that can grow it in itself and can grow God. But it also suffers. How and why does God suffer? Well, since it is seeking, and it wants, and it loves, and it wants to give life to all things, not just to itself, when the growth of life is destroyed, not life itself in total, but the growth, the speed, the movement of God's growth, which is life, when that is in part destroyed, it's not in total destroyed. I should be careful here. I don't mean the totality, a part of it. God suffers the effects of that because God wants to grow. That is his choice. And some of its choices unmet, unmet choices that are consistent, means a defiance in will, and the defiance in will causes some of the direction of God's thought to be blocked. When that happens, consciousness is diminished, and suffering is the definition of what consciousness being diminished is. So when God's consciousness is diminished, my consciousness is diminished, yours, evil's, any consciousness that is diminished, causes one to suffer. So God suffers along with the life that is interfered with by evil. But evil must be allowed to exist if it chooses to, because there has to be free will. Without a system of free will, then there's no chance for anything growing. So it's an unfortunate necessity. Some people would say it's an unfortunate evil. but a necessary one. Very interesting. Let me go through that again about why something suffers when it loses consciousness. Consciousness is the ability to connect together choices and see how they, in an infinite way, can be connected and to allow us to have understanding of what the choices, when they are connected together, mean. So consciousness is very important because a lot of people think consciousness is knowledge. Well, you can have a lot of knowledge about 100 different things, but if you can't connect those things together, the knowledge of each one of the 100, you don't have any consciousness. You just have knowledge. The more of those things you can connect together in an infinite number of different ways, potentially, the more consciousness you have. If something interferes with your ability, like evil, to connect together the choices, then the loss of the consciousness, the loss of the connections, the loss of the inclusiveness of knowledge, loss of the inclusiveness of the ability to connect together knowledge, produces suffering. It produces a sense of loss of self. Consciousness and self, same thing. Who are you? Well, you are what your consciousness is, which sometimes we use the word self to define. I don't want to confuse people with choices and knowledge, so I better go ahead and explain what knowledge is. So I didn't do that. I kind of skipped over it. Knowledge comes from the first two parts of God's mind applied to the third part. So whenever spirit is interacting with either intelligent, purely, perfectly intelligent activity, or more often with all kinds of energy, which we call form, anytime spirit is interacting with forms, then some type of knowledge is being produced. How is it produced? Knowledge is the result of how the pre-life communicates with the life and vice versa. And that's called intelligent communication. Okay? Intelligent forms of communication. If it's causing the pre-life and the life to work together. If the pre-life is not working together with the life, the laws of physics, etc., are working against life, we call those forces, and the result is unintelligent activity, which results in a lot of energy moving against other kinds of energy, producing force. Force must be produced by one energy going against another because of a lack of perfect communication between the energy and the life that is around it. Wow. So consciousness comes into play here because consciousness is being interfered with. And you have a lot of forces, and that's what evil does. It creates a lot of forces to take energy away from other life. Steals it. Which leaves the other life suffering and causes the evil to be able to grow by stealing energy. Whoa. And it does so by using force. Okay, I hope that didn't confuse you. It's a lot to digest. The point I'm trying to get at is this. God has a system. This system was designed before there were people, before there was life, before there was a universe. It had to come up with the entire system before there was anything, because the system is all interconnected. And it works. The system I'm describing is part of a general philosophy called ageless wisdom. Is it a religion? No. It doesn't tell you how to pray or how to interact with God. Does it tell you who or what God specifically might be? Not really. It tells you more about the qualities of God and how they're expressed throughout the universe. And in the kind of things, in the way I'm presenting it, some of it is my own expression, a significant portion of it comes from other sources, is meant to be able to have a reasonable understanding of God. So that's what ageless wisdom is about, to gain a reasonable understanding of God. So the life of God, which is tonight's show, and why life is, which is the show itself, which has been on for 7 years plus, is actually the very basis for tonight's title and is incorporated and has been for a long, long time, literally millions and millions of years, as the, we'll say, the premier cosmology and ontology of the universe. Cosmology deals with those parts that deal with the third part of God's mind and the laws, and ontology deals with the first two parts. And ageless wisdom is both a cosmology and an ontology. Both. Together. And they're joined together in a way that allows us, if we really understand them, to have a complete understanding of how the entire physical universe works and way beyond that. Now, we're going to talk about way beyond the physical universe next, but I do want to make sure that we have completed at least the physical part for right now. So just let me kind of encapsulate and sort of sum up how the physical universe works. The physical universe is controlled more by gravity and more by forces than any other part of the universe. The reason for that is that the amount of energy in its densest form, which we call form itself, matter, the matter and the electromagnetic parts of the matter, which is the total form of the physical universe, is the densest found in all of the universe. When matter exists, it's so dense that literally, at least on its surface, it appears to not be moving. It is in movement, but it appears to not be moving because the electromagnetic parts and the heat parts are mostly invisible, and they cause vibration to occur within molecules and atoms. Those vibrations increase the probabilities of certain effects in quantum physics. And by changing the frequency and the amount of vibration, change the probabilities, and you increase some probabilities, decrease other ones. And the results are you end up with the whole science of quantum mechanics, which is a part of quantum physics. And so we have discovered these laws, and we're still working them out, that tell us something about the physical universe. But they tell us very little about the universe beyond the physical, because matter and the electromagnetic part of matter is so much more dense than energy is anyplace else in the universe, that the laws that we know of here, in this part of the universe, do not work the same in the other parts of the universe. Because heat and vibration are significantly different. Vibration is much greater. Directionality to vibration is multiple rather than singular in some parts of the universe, and at least is one dimension greater than it is in the physical. And in addition, heat is tremendously different in the way that it affects form beyond the physical part of the universe. So all those things, and he causes vibrations, all those things are going to be changed by something called the shift in the quantum constant, or the probability factor of pre-life. Now, why is that true? Well, because the mind of God is much stronger. And so is the life, the thought of all life in the other parts of the universe that exist outside of the lowest, the basement where we are. When you change the effects of the mind of God and all of the life of God, when you change all that thought, you change the physics. Wow. Very interesting stuff. Okay, I'm going to let your brain cool off. Kind of let the vibrations smooth out. So your brain isn't vibrating quite as much. Let the quantum factors kind of relax a little. And I'm going to tell you how we're doing with Phi Chi Jizik. So far, the results have been very, very good. I just learned today that one person who has tried Phi Chi Jizik, out of quite a few so far, didn't have much results in taking two kind of maximum suggested serving sizes. And so they just it didn't work for them. Now, is that going to happen sometimes? Possibly. First of all, there's something called psychosomatic pains, where people may have had real pain at a time, but they continue to feel the similar kind of pain, even though it may not be there. Or there may be some people who have certain kind of body types and structures, et cetera, where the pain they have, this particular particular formula, which works for so many people, may not be as effective for them. A little hard to believe it wouldn't work at all. So I'm inclined toward the psychosomatic answer for people that say, oh, I took it and it had zero effect. Because I have taken it, and so have a lot of other people. And it's pretty hard to believe it will have zero effect. But then again, we want to know. And if you buy Phi Chi Jizik and it hasn't had the effect you want, even if it's better than zero, you get your money back. You can get your money back. That's right. Because our purpose in making this and selling this is to be of help to people who have pain. And if it isn't going to help you, we don't want your money. It's just that simple. If everybody said it didn't like it and didn't work, well, we'd be out of business because we made something that didn't work. So for those of you who are considering trying it, there's really, it's not like, I'm going to lose all this money. And some people are concerned that, well, it's very expensive for bottles, like $50 a bottle. And you only get 100 pills, and you might take a lot of them in the very beginning. So why use it? Why not just take the good old aspirin or, you know, something like that, some drug? And the answer is the drugs just don't do the same things that the natural herbs do. The herbs change the flow of chi in the body, and they improve the overall effects on a thing called the nadus system, sort of the electromagnetic part of the nervous system. And you don't have that effect with drugs because drugs are kind of like, for the most part, herbs reduced in their qualities, not increased. Reduced to a very significant but unfortunately narrow range, which forces the chi energy in a direction that is arbitrarily determined by some scientists and biologists who wanted to do move that way. But for some people, it might work for some time, but you need flexibility that drugs don't have, so you become intolerant to them or you develop side effects from them. And for a lot of people, the drugs just don't work at all because the angle or movement and changes in the energy field is not in accordance with what the person needs. So if we're talking about how many people are drugs not going to work on compared to how many people there's 5G Jesus not going to work on. Drugs would be far and wide more likely to have a lot of people who they just don't work on. Now, they may not work because they don't get rid of the pain, or they might get rid of some of the pain but produce more side effects than it's worth. Like, oh, gee, yeah, I took this drug and got rid of half of my pain, but the problem is that now I have eczema and I have five other problems, including irritable bowel syndrome and upset stomach with an ulcer, and I had a little mini stroke last week. And yeah, well, you know, I'm not saying that every drug's going to do that, but drugs do that, and they can cause a much worse problem. They can kill you. Could 5G Jesus kill you? Well, very, 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 very unlikely. I mean, you'd be just as likely to die from eating certain types of foods, which you might have an allergic response to. Just as likely. That's all the reason that I know of, that you could be harmed by the herbs in 5G Jesus. Because the herbs in 5G Jesus actually are on the grants list originally, generally regarded as safe, that means. And so these herbs have been used for thousands of years. And the number of people who are harmed from herbs every year is a handful. And the number of people who are harmed by drugs every year, huge. Over 100,000 deaths in this part of the world where people use drugs more than not. It's a large number of people to die from just taking something that they think is going to help them. That's to die. The number of people who get sick from drugs, way more than the number of people who die. So it's a very significant number. Okay. Now, does that mean that you should not observe whatever's on the label of a dietary supplement? No, you should. Dietary supplements still could cause some people to get ill, and under the most rare circumstances might cause a death. But the rarity is the point. I mean, it's no more than people die from just eating food. Maybe less, probably is less. Okay, so we have a safe alternative, safer alternative, that allows people to have much more flexibility in treating pain and may resolve the pain over a longer term period of use, whereas the drug may make you less able to deal with the pain, more intolerant to the pain, and eventually find the drug doesn't work at all for the pain, including similar drugs, so that you have a cross tolerance and there's no, you don't get any relief. 5G Jesus does not produce those kinds of effects. We have never seen anything like that. Or have we seen anybody become physically addicted with 5G Jesus? Yet it can be as strong as some of the very addictive types of drugs. So if it makes sense to you and you have pain and you want to try something that is in a different ballpark entirely, 5G Jesus is the answer. The other neat thing about it is virtually no side effects. Take this stuff, you can barely tell you took anything other than the fact your pain goes away. Now, if you're one of these people who, because of psychosomatic issues, if you don't feel drugged up, you don't feel like you got rid of your pain, well, it may not work for you. And I suggest you just get yourself drugged up so you feel better. But you're really seeking the effects of the drug more than you're trying to get rid of your pain, and that can be a problem. For some people, you may discover that in using 5G Jesus, because maybe you won't get the kind of relief you're looking for. But maybe then you need to look at your psychology more and what's going on in you. You have to be very introspective, if you can be. And I'm not saying that's true in every circumstance, but I think it may be for a few or some people who may use this. I don't think it's going to be anywhere near a vast number. It should be some. I expect that. And I expect that it just won't work on a few people for some pains. That's entirely consistent. You can't make something that works on absolutely everything. At least I don't believe you can. I think you can make things that work on a vast number of complaints that people have that are real, and that's very good. It's a good thing. Some people may get it for one type of pain. It may not work as well for that, but it works great for something else. Well, that's good that they discovered something that is very helpful for them. That's fine. Okay, so let me go on and now talk about God and the universe. Okay, so God, I think we've got the basic system. I hope that you're beginning to see how God's life really is expressed through our universe. And it makes just every bit of sense. One of the things I love about ageless wisdom is that it just makes sense. I had such a hard time reading so many different religions and trying to understand so much about what was supposed to be an explanation of what God was that never seemed to get anywhere. There were the same, virtually to my mind, the same arguments, the same problems, no matter where I turned. But discovering ageless wisdom, both experientially, first, strangely, in my case, and then through reading and education, it totally changed my mind around. Now, I was kind of fortunate in that I was director of a mental health institute where someone else was doing some experiments, not myself, in consciousness. And it was really important stuff. It was things that at that time I wasn't giving much credence to, but nonetheless, later on I changed my mind. And through going into a sensory isolation tank and being able to visit other dimensions of time and space, if not for very long, but some periods of time, sometimes many hours, I was able to perform literally physics experiments. Luckily, I had some background in physics, and that helped me as a semi-scientific investigation, as much as a person can investigate using their own consciousness in a process of understanding consciousness. That's how I first discovered ageless wisdom. It wasn't through reading. Then I said, oh, well, I better go read and see what other people found out, because this is pretty far-out stuff. I want to make sure that other people had found this stuff out. And then I discovered there was a whole bunch of stuff out there, a whole bunch. Some of it very consistent with what I was experiencing. And it was through this that I really became aware of ageless wisdom. Some people say, well, you just read about it and then you start writing about it. Well, that isn't the truth. There's nothing wrong with that if somebody did. But that isn't how I came about in understanding. Really, a couple of years before I was seriously reading. So, and then even in the serious reading, that took way more than another 6-7 years before I was in the space where, through the reading and the experiences, I could say, I think I got this thing maybe figured out. Now, not anywhere near where I am today, because we all grow. And so as I then continued my education in physics in more recent times, and then did so in other areas of scientific study, and was also investigating the psyche of people, because I did many, many years of psychotherapy, besides being on the institutional directing side, that gave me a wealth of understanding, That just helped me to grow. So I can't really say I was the same person 20 years or 30 years ago. That would be ridiculous. And I wouldn't be part of God's plan if that were true. You see, if we don't change, if we don't grow, then we're really not part of what God's purpose is. God's purpose is that life grows, so it grows. The parts of life that tend not to grow are evil. Some of them are not yet evil, they're just dark. But what they are missing is God's direction. They don't have that. They don't understand virtue. They don't understand light or light and form. They move towards the darkness. They understand the darkness only to the level that it gives them what they want, which is usually pleasure and things. And that's what they're seeking to live for. That's a terrible position to be in, because it leads to, eventually, the very thing that they think they're getting away from. They believe they're in control, and what's really happening is they're losing control, and they become afraid of death, they become afraid of God, and if they're not afraid of God, then they are afraid of there not being a God. Either way, they're afraid, and they refuse to admit it. Instead, they say, I'm the all-powerful one. I am so powerful, nothing can stop me, nothing can control me, until the real problem comes up. Those laws that God created to prevent evil from spreading indefinitely, they eventually come up against ours. And all of a sudden, they can no longer even maintain themselves as human beings any longer. And they become subhuman for a million years or longer. And that's a real big problem. If you still have the semi-consciousness of a human being and you're living as a flower or an insect or some lower form of life, or maybe you're a rock, it doesn't matter. Whatever you are, you don't have any more sense than whatever that thing is that you are in, and that's where your consciousness has to live and gradually develop itself into a higher and higher life form until it eventually can regain itself as a human. That could be millions of years. So evil suffers tremendously in this process because every time it has to go to a lower form of life to exist in, eventually, it is suffering immensely because its consciousness cannot be expressed through the awareness and sense of that thing. And it's trapped. What a terrible outcome. Now, some people can be evil for hundreds of thousands of years before they actually lose the ability to remain human. It's called cracking, for those of you who are familiar with that word. But at any rate, when it happens suddenly, and to their thinking without warning, and suddenly they're a worm running around on the ground, and no longer capable of doing any more than any worm can do, but their consciousness is still the same as right before they turned into a worm. So how would you like to be a worm with your own consciousness? I assume it's higher than an evil person's. And live out countless lifetimes as a worm and then maybe as a rodent and maybe as this or that. Who knows? But how would you, that would seem just an incredible, terrible circumstance. Far worse than just being imprisoned as a human being. And again, this happens because God's rules, God's laws, they are, you can't get away from them because they affect pre-life, and then they have a controlling nature the lower forms of life because of group souls. It's truly amazing. Now, it is true that evil is a group soul, by the way. But, you know, once you become a worm, you're of no value to evil. So it says, well, I'm not going to inform you anymore. You gave up your individual soul to join me, but you know what? I'm evil, so screw you. And you end up then going back to being part of a group soul, which is still a great being, it's a wonderful being, but it's used to controlling worms and helping the instincts of worms, and that's the only thing that it imbibes you with. And yet you have this other consciousness that you can't express through the form of life you're in, if you're evil. Wow. I guess God, when that happens, says, that'll fix you. I like that terminology. That'll fix you. Once evil has had its comeuppance, I think that's a very appropriate thing to say to it. That'll fix you. And it's not done in hostility. It's sort of done in having the understanding and the joy of that understanding that God is such a great being that it would never let all of life suffer because it had to give free will to all of life that allows some humans to become evil. It did this so that all can grow without interference. And it's great when evil becomes aware of this, even if it has to take it becoming an ant or a worm or a plant for eons of time. Very interesting. All right, let's talk about some of the other dimensions of time and space. All right, so we've got some things that change in the physics. The first is that God's mind extends all the way to the physical realm. It's here. But the amount that spirit is here is much limited by the form that spirit is attempting to inform and become part of. The forms are much more resistant to the thought of God. It isn't that God's thought is weak. It's just that it's weakened by the tenacity and the resistance of the forms that it's trying to have some effect on. And it eventually, in some cases, just doesn't have enough strength to deal with the forces that are terrible in some circumstances from the tremendous amount of gravity and tremendous amount of density of form that exists in the dense world. When we move on to the next dimension of time and space, because these forms have greater dimensionality, at least double, at the next juncture, which is the astral world, the greater dimensionality allows the form to vibrate at a much higher frequency, with much less amounts of heat or energy imposed. And in terms of electromagnetic forces, the phase of the energy is much more open to changing. So the direction of the energy can change much more readily, and the frequency can be much higher for the same input of energy because the form has much less density and gravity is much weaker. This increases the event of what is called probability. You have higher events of probability and something called the quantum constant, which is a measure of how probable something is going to be, grows. It just becomes significantly larger. And this quantum constant, sometimes referred to as Planck's constant. Who's Planck? Well, it's a guy who discovered quantum physics. I mean, he actually did. He understood more about it in an earlier time even than Albert Einstein did. And he was a predecessor of Einstein. And so what he did is he found out what the consistency of probability was for the physical world. He actually came up with a number. It's a very small number, meaning that the probability for change is very, very small in the physical world. But the probability goes way up when you get to the astral world, so much so that thought controls energy to a vastly greater amount. So here in the physical world, let me give you an example. Let's say you or I say, gee, I would like to have a nice new house. And, you know, think of the house, and here nothing happens. Or it seems nothing happens. You don't suddenly have a bunch of energy come together from the surrounding universe and make a house because you can't control the energy with just your own thought. Even though you have maybe a really good thinker, you can't do it. Now, if you had a whole planet full of people and they all thought exactly the same way, they might be able to create a house. But try and get about 7 billion people all thinking the same way at the same time and in exactly the same phase. In other words, their thought is moving in exactly the same direction. Pretty hard to do. if you could do it, you actually could manifest, they call it, a house. But that's about maybe the limits of what you could do, not much more than that. At any rate, you go to the astral world, same situation, and you think of, well, gee, you know, I kind of like to have a two-story with this and that and another thing. And as you're thinking it, literally the surrounding energy moves into and takes the form of your imaginative thought and becomes the house as close as you can think of it that you want it. Wow. And it just stays there, by the way, for a significant length of time, provided you and others don't think in ways to change it. Because if others come by and say, gee, I don't like your house, if they go change it, they could, you see. So that creates kind of a bit of a problem. But nonetheless, this is miraculous stuff we're talking about. All because this thing called the quantum constant has changed. Now, if you want to know more about this, I mentioned this book before, you can read Mr. Tompkins in Wonderland, a book written in the late 40s. But still today is a great, great book. And sometimes it's combined with Mr. Tompkins' Discovers the Atom or Explores the Atom. This author wrote more than just that. But Mr. Tompkins in Wonderland is a great book, and it explains some of the physics that I'm explaining to you. Wow. So energy follows thought greater than its own. The thought of energy is pretty strong in the physical world because of gravity. What is gravity? Gravity is the same consistent thought of pre-life, of form, of energy, matter, wanting to just get together and hang out and be part of other matter. That's what its thought is. We call it gravity. The more there is of it, the more it attracts others to its own self, and it just gets bigger. It tends to create a sphere, which we know, because it's equal. It's all equal. If its thought was different, it would create, instead of a sphere, kind of like different shapes and things, but it doesn't. It just has basically one kind of thought. Oh, I want to be bigger. I want more of me. More, more, more of me, me, me. That's what it does. And the denser the energy, the more it thinks that way, so the stronger the type of gravity. So things that are very dense produce very strong gravitational fields as they get bigger, whereas things that lack density do not produce the same level of gravitational fields for the same size. So you could take a planet like Jupiter, maybe 1,000 times bigger in diameter than the Earth, but it's only a few hundred times greater in gravity because it isn't as dense. It's composed mostly of gases. As a matter of fact, even its core is mostly a form of solid hydrogen with some solid helium, frozen to very, very cold levels, but also crushed by the 300 or so times of gravity. Kind of a strange thing. It's hard for us to understand that, because most of the time when we think of things getting denser, we think of getting very hot. But because Jupiter is composed mostly of gas on its outside, it doesn't hold most of its heat in. And so it has let go of a lot of the heat, but the stuff is still frozen, so you have solid hydrogen. It's actually called a metal. How does hydrogen become a metal? Well, it has to do with the way it shares its electrons with other hydrogen around it. It's really weird stuff. We're talking like weird stuff goes on. And that's because of the way that gravity works. Gravity works based upon not just how much there is of a form, but also how dense it is. It's just that simple. Very low-density things create very strange gravitational effects. Okay, getting back to our universe. All right, so the astral world is kind of a neat place because you're not confined by gravity so much. You can fly virtually anywhere you want to go. But here's another neat little trick. If you've already been someplace and you have a pretty good imagination and a memory of the place, if you recreate it in your mind, you can instantly uncreate your present existence where you are and recreate yourself to this other location, which could be thousands and thousands of miles away, instantly. Talk about moving fast. There's really no movement. You're just ceasing to exist one place and existing another place through something called quantum, this is quantum physics again, quantum simultaneous expression or plurality. So basically, for a split second, you're actually in both places at the same time. You cease to exist in one place, and then you are existing in the other place that you chose to be. Kind of a strange thing, but you could be in two places at the same time. And because you're in two places at the same time, no time actually takes place unless your thought is not perfectly clear, meaning it is, you don't think at the speed of light, then it does use up some time. It can use up seconds where it would normally take you hours or days to get someplace, or at least minutes. It takes a few seconds. Because your mind is not so clear, you don't have pure light, and some of the energy is being used up because of a lack of perfect light. So people with enlightened minds can go anywhere in no time at all, and people with less than enlightened minds but still have sufficient consciousness to create strong enough thought could go someplace in maybe a few seconds or so of time. But still, pretty amazing stuff we're talking about here. And this is just the beginning of the changes in physics between the astral and the physical worlds. And remember, the astral dimension is the one closest to us, where the mind of God is not having as much as an effect on the forms of things as it is on, in higher dimensions of time and space. Because of this effect that people who are not enlightened, which is almost everybody that exists in the astral world, or you wouldn't be there, wasting some period of time and separating some time from space, etc., because that is going on all the time when people exist there, you have some strange overall changes or effects. Time is still being separated from space, and it is not whole. Remember, we talked about time starting because you have all of this gravity. But time, you have more time to do something in the astral world than you do while you're physically alive because of a thing called dilation. And so you have more time, but you're still separating time from space because you're not enlightened to the fullest extent. And the results are kind of confusing. You have a lot more time in which to do things, so your life expectancy relative to people who are living in the physical world is much longer. Somebody who's alive here for 30 years may be alive in the same 30 years here in the astral world for 600 years. Possible. At least 450, 500. So it depends where you are. And where you are depends upon how conscious you are. The more conscious you are, the more time you have. And the less time is being used up in which to do anything. So you do everything. You're actually doing things super fast by our standards. We couldn't even see the people moving there because they're moving so quickly. But the point is you have lots of time, but there's still some separation of time because it isn't perfect for virtually everybody who's alive there. And so that separation of time causes an odd effect, and that is that people do not have as much reference towards the future as they do in higher dimensions of time and space. They mostly are concerned with the past and the present. And we here almost never have any understanding of the present. Anytime you try to think of the present, you're always thinking of the past. Try it. You'll see. It's very, very difficult for us to think in the present here. I mean, it's almost impossible. Some people can train themselves, and it does take a high level of consciousness, but just to do it for no purpose other than to do it doesn't really achieve much and you'll never really be doing it. You think you'll be doing it, but you won't. At any rate, getting to the reality of the situation, so we mostly think in the past, people in the astral world, because they do think much faster than we do here in some respects, and they are more conscious on an average, and because the physics have changed, can usually think more in the past than someone in the present. They actually can think right in the present moment, but they almost can never think in the future. They could think about the future, but they can't think in the future. Now, what does that mean, to think in the future? Well, if you can think in the future, you can experience the actual effects, as if they're really happening to you, of a complete part of time, past, present, and future. You could actually live out something in the future before it actually took place. You can't do that in the astral world, but you can do it in the next dimension of time and space we're going to talk about. So the interesting thing here is that God's expression of itself is limited not just by the fact that he created all of this life, but the consciousness of that life also limits God tremendously and prevents God from even experiencing whole amounts of time, from being able to express, be expressive in the lowest dimensions of time and space without great difficulty. So to create anything in the physical world is terribly laborious, can take years and years of time, with tremendous number of mistakes, because we can't see the present, and barely see the present, and can almost not see anything about the future. So after we do something, we've got to do it in most circumstances. Very difficult for us. That, so that when we don't get things right, we call something a mistake, but it's really the inability to experience the outcome in the future. That's really what's wrong. We separated time and space too much. In the astral world, it's not so bad. We can experience the mistakes, many of them, before. Not all of them by any stretch, but at least it's better than the physical world. So our experience of life is different, and the experience of the life of God is different. God's expression of itself in the astral world is considerably different than God's expression of itself here, again, through the life that it has previously created. I'm going a little fast here because there's still a lot to cover, and I'm looking at the clock. All right. Some of this is getting deep, I know, but it really, if you want to understand God, God is not a simple subject, right? So I'm doing the best I can within the limited time I have for tonight's show. Obviously, this is a subject that could take more than one show to really get into. Okay. So looking at this time thing now, when you move on in life, I'm going to leave the astral world alone right now because I don't have enough time to really get into the astral world. Getting into the mental world, finally time is starting to come together for us. But unfortunately, there's two parts to the mental world. There's the lower mental and the higher mental. The lower mental deals with the forms of thoughts that are created through concepts in the higher mental. And the reason the mental world is split is because although time is represented in whole amounts, so you can actually experience the future of whatever you're thinking about in your past and present sense, you can actually experience, if you have strong enough thought, strong enough consciousness, the future of time, even in the lower mental world. What you experience in the lower mental is mostly the forms that are going to be created and their interactions together. Whereas the higher mental, you experience the concepts, of those forms. Change a concept and you've changed a million forms. Change a form, you've changed one form only. You can see how much more you can get done in creation if you work in concepts than if you work in forms. Most people will not experience the working in concepts until the very end of their existence in the lower mental world, and then they're going and rejoining their soul in consciousness in the higher mental world. So unfortunately, this tremendous advantage to working in concepts is mostly experienced while a person is their soul again, and not so much whether a human being. But at least when you think of something, if you're fully conscious in the lower mental world, you can actually go through virtual realities where you experience what that existence is like. And that's so amazing. And you can do this with hundreds of other people at the same time who are also fully conscious. Most people that go to the mental world do not experience full consciousness for a long time because all of the egotism that they've experienced and unfortunately chosen to think through while they were astrally and physically alive, at least in that lifetime, and sometimes even in prior lifetimes, comes to bear on them. And until they overcome that egotism, they aren't able to fully use time and experience all three parts of time at the same time, and they can't even experience other fully conscious resonance. So you get very isolated through this kind of problem of time into mostly the past and present, with trying to develop a sense of future time, but not having a balance enough to actually experience other people around you and just living your life alone, even though people are there, because the dimensionality has increased. Instead of being two dimensions, you've got an added dimension of whole time that people are living in. But if you're not living in that same dimension the whole time, you're only living in a part of that dimension, you're either in the past or the present trying to figure out what your past has been like. But spending so much of your energy and time doing that, you're not living much of the future, where others are actually doing that, until you awaken to that effect. So God, through time, becomes a whole being through time in the minimal. God, through the direction of its movement, becomes a whole being in the astral world. And God, through the resistance of energy and matter to move itself, becomes the most knowledgeable it could possibly become in that limited environment of not being able to interact correctly in the physical world. So the challenges are incredible in God's thought and mind in each of these dimensions. And these are the lower dimensions of time and space. These are the dimensions of time and space where human beings live. There are beings way beyond human, which we just have a few minutes to even talk about, and where God is growing through that kind of life. I've put most of the emphasis in tonight's show on the human life, because it's about us, really. I mean, to talk about the life beyond human, I'll touch on it, but it's not really that relevant to us. We have trouble grasping what that would really mean to us. And with a little more than 10 minutes left, that isn't going to do very much, but I'll do the best I can. So God in the mental world is finally expressing itself in a creative way through mostly human beings and human souls, who now are able to experience the wholeness of time, meaning that when God is creative, or when someone is co-creating with God and helping to grow God, God is growing not just in its understanding of its own past and the immediate present, but also in potential futures. It actually experiences those potential futures before they are fully events in time and space. But when they are like virtual existences, God can experience these virtual existences almost ad infinitum. And so can some souls as they develop themselves. Amazing stuff, for sure. Okay, what happens then if we move on to higher dimensions? Well, that gets beyond human. The human soul lives in the second sub-world of the mental world. And right in the middle of that second sub-world, in a place called the fourth sub-sub-world. So it's living a very narrow existence. And within that realm, the quantum constant is enormously greater. It's hundreds of times greater than it is here, where we are. When you expand the quantum constant by that amount, the probability of future events is so much easier to create things that massive amounts of new futures can be lived through and experienced within a very, very short period of time relative to our time here. So life is expanded again. You could be living for thousands of years in the time that a human being is living through one lifetime here. And in those thousands of years, you're interacting with hundreds or maybe thousands of other souls who are trying out different ways of co-creating with their creator by creating new personalities. who will live out their existence like we are, in the lower realms where the soul cannot go to. And so it's an amazing process. The soul is kind of living like a god. And it's doing the same kind of sacrificing. It's allowing the same kind of free will in the personality. All the same things a god does, the soul does, because the soul's got this thing figured out. The soul is an expert in ageless wisdom. You see, souls innately know ageless wisdom. And unfortunately for most people, until they start becoming more of their soul, ageless wisdom eludes them. It's difficult to understand. Some people don't get it at all. And for those people, they're just not going to be ready for it. But that's okay. It's fine. All right, so what goes beyond that? Well, the soul eventually can free itself. It no longer is in this narrow part of the higher mental world, and it can elevate itself all the way to the fourth sub-world of the Buddhic or intuitional world. This is a whole other dimension of time and space. The quantum constant goes up by thousands and thousands of times, like 50,000 times where the soul goes to first. 50,000, 60,000, eventually goes up to 140,000. Wow. When you increase the quantum constant by that amount, something new happens. You're not only able to share a virtual reality of interactive experiences where you're experiencing yourself interacting with others in a future sense of tune, but now you can experience what all the other selves are simultaneously experiencing with you, and vice versa, in all three parts of time. Whoa. Is that a little bigger experience? It doesn't mean your individuality goes away. You're still an individual, and you grow every second you experience all the other individuals, and you're experiencing what they're sensing. And to some extent, what they're thinking. Wow. You experience their knowledge of their thoughts. You can't experience their consciousness yet. And you can't experience all of the ways they're making their choices yet. So you're not experiencing their creativity, and you're not experiencing their inclusivity. But you can't experience their knowledge, so you become all knowledgeable. Omniscient is another word for that. So all people in this realm of buddhi are omniscient beings. They are sharing the third part of God's mind together, and they're doing it through their awareness, their senses, being all inclusively connected, making their knowledge one. Pretty neat stuff. Pretty neat stuff. That's still only the middle growth of God's life. That's not even past the middle of its own development. Remember, God is growing simultaneously in all these dimensions of time and space. It isn't happening just one or the other. It's all happening together. This is the life of God. The collective of all the life in the Buddhic realm is one of the dimensions of the collective life of God. And the same for the mental, the same for the astral, the same for the physical. The physical is more of a restrictive and forceful life than it is a free, creative life. But sometimes that's how you really test the mettle of yourself. Okay, so I kind of keep going here. I'm going to run out of time. All right. So then, eventually, that's one being that's a couple of different levels of beings beyond the human being, okay? Now we can eventually get to the atmic plane. Some people call it nirvana. I don't get what you call it. Okay, that's above the intuitional now, the next one. This is another dimension of time and space, millions of times greater in the quantum constant. So the creative ability is becoming enormous. Now you not only can share in each other's knowledge, your ability now becomes that you can share all of the ways that each other can interact, all of the ways that the senses could be used to change the modality of movement of energy from one space to another. You become all-powerful, all-powerful, omnipotent. You're already omniscient, and it's plain below. But this part of God is now omniscient and omnipotent, all-powerful. You're able to share all forms of energy with all other beings, while you can also do all the other things I just said. Whoa. In the past, present, and future. This allows you to create whole worlds, literally. An entire world could be created by someone who is omnipotent, a world like Earth. You would probably do it with others, but the point is that it's an amazing position to be in. And it's still only part of God's life. It's not the end of God's life by any stretch. Okay, let's go on. Now that was past, present, and future, remember. Now we reach a part of the universe where you share the consciousness of all other beings, and you choose to give up the omnipotent part. It's kind of there, but you choose to allow that to happen in the plane below yours, the spiritual plane, or the atmic plane, or plane of nirvana. That plane is where you allow it to happen, and you're giving it up on your plane. You sacrifice it, okay, but you share oneness and consciousness with all the other beings. Oneness and consciousness, oneness and direction. You know the direction of thought of all other beings, while you also have a sharedness in sense with other beings that you had already attained in the lower realms. But you give up that too. You decide to allow that for the parts of you that are going to be working in the Buddhic realm, and you give up the omnipotent part for those parts of you that are going to be working in the spiritual realm or the atmic plane or the nirvanic plane. You're giving that up so that you can concentrate only on consciousness. And that's called the monadic plane, and you live with other beings called monads. And there's a lot more to explain about that. We don't have enough time. So finally, we're going to get to the last plane. That's called the logoic plane. The logoic plane, or the plane of one, ADI, the ultimate plane of beingness, in which you share co-creation with all of the beings. And you experience the creation of everything in the universe, past, present, and future, for all things, alive or pre-life, in every way possible. And that's the ultimate way of being in God's life. But it's all happening at the same time that all the other parts of God are happening in the lower realms. Simultaneously, God is experiencing all of these things in all ways. In the logoic realm, it is experiencing it in all parts of tongue as they are occurring to all life forms. But also God is growing at a rate larger and faster than any life form could possibly. So God is the sum of all. God experiences all. Yet everything can experience God up to the point that it reaches the highest level of logoic plane until it leaves the universe, and the rest is virtual from that point. We are out of tongue. I know this last part I didn't go into as much depth as I like to. The life of God, an amazing thing, and hopefully we can all appreciate this great being who created us all and who we are now helping to co-create with. Until next week, this has been Niles McFlower for Why Life Is.